This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds.
This month I'm speaking with Dr. Benjamin B. Olshan, former professor of philosophy, the history and philosophy of science and technology and design at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. Dr. Olshan is a researcher, musician, artist, consultant, and author of several books, including Lost Knowledge, Deciphering Reality, and The Mysteries of the Marco Polo Maps. We discuss lost technologies, the presence of an ancient advanced society, deciphering reality, and how the concept of time itself has changed since the ancient era.
Yeah, I guess I'd like to start with the fact that you kind of study a wide range of things and have very interdisciplinary work. So maybe you can start us off with just sort of giving us a teaser of some of the different things that you study in the kind of wide range of classical interests.
A very broad range of things, and there's a whole background to that, but very interested in classical history, and classics was my major as an undergraduate, so Latin, Greek, and ancient history, but then also industrial design. My brother's an architect, and he got me very interested in design, and then through a strange series of coincidences, after I finished a PhD in history of science, there were no jobs. Not surprisingly, you know, if you have academic background, but there was a job teaching design, drawing, painting, model making in Taiwan. So I did that. So classical history, a history of science, industrial design. I like music a lot. I play guitar, play bass. I have two albums out now. I'm just interested in mainly popular music and world music. Languages, because if you travel, you know, you're exposed to languages, and Latin gave me a tremendous base for languages. I'm also interested in linguistics, because like your family, you know, I have a family, we speak Japanese, Chinese, English, Spanish, French in our household. So I'm interested in linguistics. And then when I came back to the States and started teaching in university here, there was basically a hole in the program and a vacancy for somebody just to teach straight philosophy. And I had done some Stoic philosophy in graduate school, so I was pegged to teach Greek philosophy. And then because of some research I did and from living in Asia, I also got into Taoist philosophy in particular. Not in a New Age sense, I'm a real Taoist philosophy reading Zhuangzi and the Tao Te Ching. So yeah, things have just sort of expanded and expanded, and then I try to maintain all those, and I do, because people ask me to teach this or talk about that, and I've written three books about three very different subjects.
And I think it's absolutely fantastic, and like I personally, it's very funny to me because I've also studied art history and linguistics, so there you actually have very similar crossover to my personal interests. But I'd love to hear from you what value you find in having such different backgrounds. Like, what kind of perspectives that would give you?
That's kind of a classic question, and it's funny because I had written some notes for this conversation because your questions were very good. So I took your questions and wrote out some answers, and I said that I wanted to comment on the disadvantages first, which, as many people know, it's terrible for an academic career. Or any kind of career. So I ended up at an art school, so it was good. I had a wonderful boss, a dean, who said, this is great. And he let me teach what I want, develop courses that I want. But when I've looked for other academic positions, it's always very problematic because they talk about multidisciplinarity or transdisciplinarity, which is kind of the cooler term, but they don't really practice it and they don't want that. So the disadvantage is that in terms of a career, it's kind of pejorative. You know, our current culture likes specialists. The problem, if you've studied under a specialist, it can be boring, but also more particularly, specialists themselves then lose out on some of their own specialty because they can't see beyond the technical parameters of what they've studied. So for example, if you teach linguistics, you know nothing about culture or psychology or the brain, then your linguistics research is going to be very delimited. And that's a real problem. And something I often tell students, you know, if you go back in time and you look at a figure like Niels Bohr, who was a physicist, physicists back then met with artists, they wrote, they listened to classical music, you know, they had all these influences which they accepted as part of their specialist sphere of physics, let's say. And so that it's kind of an advantage for me because it allows me to see things with greater perspicacity, but it's disadvantage in terms of making a living, which I've been able to do, fortunately.
Yeah, it's funny though, because we people know, even like in current day popular icons, that the marriage of very different backgrounds can have, you know, absolutely fantastic effects. And like the most famous example always is, say, like Steve Jobs. If he hadn't studied calligraphy, what would the future of computing be, you know?
Right, exactly. And I think that when you're in other disciplines in addition to your own, it gives you all kinds of insights. And there are many examples. Steve Jobs, the other, the composer, John Cage, who was interested in Taoism, and that really changed the way he thought about musical structures. But the other thing also I wanted to say in answer to your question, that I do agree. I've read, you know, some other people's works who are sort of multidisciplinary, and there is a tendency to sort of be a dilettante then. And that's problematic in that they're working in various fields, but without the specialty. So I've read, for example, people that do map history, and they really don't know map history, and they fudge things, they miss sources, etc. So another aspect of being multidisciplinary is the discipline part. You have to be an expert. It's like being a pentathlete, where you have to do all the things well. So what I've tried to do for myself is that anytime I do a project like that, I beat myself over the head until I do it right. So for example, I did this book called Lost Knowledge, and part of it required some Chinese text. And my Chinese is conversational, we can talk in Chinese, but I had to translate some passages very precisely. And so I went into great technical detail. I sent my translation to a very famous professor of sinology right here in Philadelphia, had him review it, had other editors review it in the manuscript, and they gave it the thumbs up. And I remember running downstairs telling my wife, I said, they just wrote back and they said my Chinese translation was great. And she said, well, who cares? They said, well, I'm not a sinologist, you know, I don't teach sinology, but I had to meet that standard, right, for that book. And so I think that somebody that does multidisciplinarity has to do it always to the professional standard. And that's true with everything. Like the other joke I have is I play a lot of music, but I have some of my students listen to music because I teach professional musicians, you know, guys that are jazzers, singers, etc. And they'll say, oh, Dr. Olson, that's pretty good, but you know, the bass part, that's wrong. And I go home and I fix it. So I think anybody that does multiple disciplines has to really always read the professional journals, look at the professional standards, and kind of subject themselves to that kind of discipline.
Yeah, so it's always sort of funny, though, when you look back in history and you see the careers that have that the interdisciplinary folks have been most interested in or define themselves as the most versus what, you know, eventually made them the most famous. So you think of like Leonardo da Vinci, of course, you know, now we usually think of him as an artist, but his most important thing in his mind was the military inventions, or, you know, Simone Beauvoir would have, you know, this, she thought of herself more of as a novelist, and now we think more of her as a feminist. What do you think is going to be both the thing that you think is the most important to you versus maybe the thing you would have the most impact in?
Oh, that's funny. I think my legacy will be a very cranky old guy. That's what I think my lasting legacy will be. Well, what I think, it's funny, among my students, because I teach multiple subjects. I teach industrial design, kind of basic anthropology course, philosophy, etc. What students seem to be most captivated by are the philosophy lessons. So I'll be known by them as kind of a philosophy teacher, although I would never say I'm a philosophy professional, because I know people that really do that at a very high level. I think for me, it's ironic because I have all this academic training, but what I'm most enamored of a lot is music and art. And I've taught painting and drawing, and I play music, and also athletics. This is one of the problems that many listeners to this program may feel sympathetic to. If you grow up in an intellectual family, which I did, both parents are professors, the idea of sports was just pushed out the door. But I love soccer. I ran track. I ran cross country. I did professional cycling for a while, briefly in my late teens and 20s. So I would have loved to have been remembered for that, as a person who did sports, et cetera, who played soccer, into his late 50s. But probably the legacy will be primarily as somebody who dealt with philosophical issues, kind of like you said, before we started this session, that a lot of that stuff is so important now, particularly vis-a-vis younger people and struggling to find meaning. So, if my amateur philosophical efforts help them, I'm really glad. And I also hope, too, that my philosophical writings about physics, which are in my latest book, I hope that also is what I'll be sort of framed as.
Can I just say, with regards to the sport jock nerd dynamic, I always like to think of the ancient world in that that was not such an issue. I mean, if you were supposed to be, if your mind was sound, so was your body. They weren't so divorced as we like to think of it nowadays.
That's right. In fact, I just told my daughter that she's starting Latin now in ninth grade, and I told her, in a mens sana corpore sana, I said, she's, what does that mean? I said that both parts are important and that both help each other. And then we went out for a 3-mile run. So I said, that's what it's all about. And it's funny that there is that kind of split now, not among everyone, but it's in families it happens. And so I have not subjected my daughter to that kind of intellectual only framework, which I think is problematic for a number of reasons.
Why don't we sort of steer back into the ancient world a little, since that's sort of more the realm of classical wisdom. And I'd like to talk about actually your most recent book, Lost Knowledge. Is that your most recent one? Yes.
Yes, I had it backwards. I'm sorry. Yes, Lost Knowledge is my most recent book. And I did them all three of them very close together. So I get confused. But yes, Lost Knowledge is the most recent one. It was out just about a year or so ago.
So it's called Lost Knowledge, The Concept of Vanished Technologies and Other Human Histories, which I think just sounds absolutely fascinating and sort of captivating from the get-go. Maybe you can start us off by sort of explaining a little bit some of the lost technologies that you're referring to.
So that's a great question. And yeah, it's a funny title, and it was a difficult title to settle on. Because there's kind of a history of books that talk about ancient technology. And if you're a classicist or a person with any kind of classical knowledge, you may know some of these. So the most famous probably is an author named K.D. White, who wrote a book called Greek and Roman Technology, and has these beautiful illustrations of everything from mills to navigation systems, et cetera, that the Greeks and Romans devised. And I love that stuff, and I got interested in that stuff probably in high school. And then I had a very wonderful professor in graduate school who actually did research on the Antikythera mechanism, the Greek computer mechanism. So I liked that, and I wasn't going to write a book about that stuff because people had done it well and are doing it well. So what I thought was, well, that's interesting. And then in Eastern culture, we have Science and Civilization in China. Joseph Needham wrote this incredible work that looks at that. And that's actually an ongoing project. But what I got interested in, because it was less explored, was two aspects. One is that you have cultures that have technical knowledge that are pre-literate or non-literate cultures. So they know things about medicine, botanical medicine. They know things about navigation. They know things about agriculture and astronomy, but it's all transmitted orally or through demonstration. And the analogy I always use, it's like you learn to ride a bike not by reading a book, right? A lot of women, when they are pregnant and give birth, I learned this stuff, you know, by seeing it, you don't read a lot of books. Like my wife refused to read any book when she was pregnant. You talk to your mom, you talk to other women, you know, et cetera. So there's so much knowledge that's transmitted that way. So one aspect of the book was that, and that how knowledge that's transmitted that way can become lost because people either forget the stories, the rituals, the dances, the performances, or what happens, and this is a very interesting topic, is that people remember the rituals, they forget the content. And I have to say, I was very influenced by a writer named William Irwin Thompson. He gave a talk many, many years ago in New York, and he talked about the Rapunzel fairy tale, how that's actually encoded botanical information. Little Red Riding Hood also is encoded information, but what happens is, you ask 30 students, they all know the story, or even worse, they know the Disney version, but they don't know the content anymore. Freemasonry is another interesting example. All kinds of rituals that the Masons have forgot what the content is. So a whole strand of the book was that, and the other strand was, as I was reading many of these stories about technologies, I found some very fantastical technologies. So you'll find Chinese stories about flying devices and Hopi stories about how people climb upon a shield and go from place to place. You know, it's the stuff you see in Ancient Aliens on the TV show. But I became interested in this idea that ancient peoples speculated on technology, that they thought about very strange kind of devices. And then the final element was that you even find in ancient sources pretty sophisticated idea, which is that a society can develop technologies to such a point that they implode. And this is what I kind of jokingly call, I don't think I say this in the book, but when I lecture on it, I call the Planet of the Apes scenario, where human beings destroy themselves through excessive technology. So the book kind of delves deeply into those two strands of ancient thought. And you find this in Greek sources, in Plato, and then I do a kind of comparative study because you find it in indigenous literature, in Arabic literature, in Chinese sources, etc.
There is so much interesting things you've just said there. I don't know where to begin. So maybe I'll start with the mythology. It's really interesting about that idea that we have information encoded in oral mythology without knowing it. And just thinking of a modern example, I remember during the Boxing Day tsunami, I don't know if you remember, there was a tribe, I think it was somewhere in maybe Indonesia or something like that, that they had a story that if the ocean ever goes out, to run up a hill. And sure enough, the ocean went out, which is a sign of a tsunami coming, and everybody ran up the hill. And that one particular village who had had that oral story all survived because they knew what to do, which is just...
And a story like that probably would not be so literal. There would be some metaphor, like when the waters are consumed, you know, and you find that it's encoded in all kind of allegorical language. And, you know, stupid Westerners read it literally, but Indigenous peoples understand those, yeah, and it saved their life. Absolutely, that's a perfect example of that.
Do you have any examples that from the ancient world of a myth that would have had a story like that?
Well, the example I use in class a lot that I think Bruno Bettelheim talks about in his book is the Rapunzel story, and one of the interesting things about Rapunzel story and Little Red Riding Hood is that those stories actually go back to the ancient world. So that's one thing, you know, that has to be understood. There was also a book, now I'm forgetting the title, that talks about the Homeric myths as encoding astronomical information. So that's another example. There's again, for people who are listening to this program, watching this program, there's a great book called Hamlet's Mill. And it basically looks at the ancient world and any number of stories that contain coded information, particularly about astronomy. And that's probably the most common one you'll find because ancient peoples had to understand calendrical systems for planting, harvesting, etc. I like the Little Red Riding Hood because it's an easy one to teach. And it's funny. So you tell students, tell me the Little Red Riding Hood story, which again goes back to the ancient world, and they say, well, you know, there's this girl and she's dressed in red and she encounters this wolf. And of course, the entire story is a narrative about a mother telling a daughter who's just hit puberty, which is symbolized by the red, you know, the menstrual color, to watch out for men. And it's very funny that in Chinese, the word for a man who's a predator is silang, which means a wolf, essentially. So that's a great example that I like to use in teaching because it's sort of shocking and it makes sense. The story would relate to classical knowledge that you're interested in is one that I talk about in the book, which is the Ring of Gyges. Do you know this story?
Yes. Is it? It's not the Lord of the Rings, but it's close.
Well, the Lord of the Rings was influenced by the Ring of Gyges. So the Ring of Gyges is like a couple pages in Plato in the Republic. And what's interesting is that Plato is citing the story. So it's actually a folk tale that exists in other sources in the ancient world. And then Plato just has one version. And the Ring of Gyges is interesting because, yeah, it's a morality tale. It's about a ring, a magic ring that makes you invisible. And this is why Tolkien takes that and runs with the kind of moral aspect. But in my book, what I found interesting about the story is that it's this very kind of mundane folk tale. You know, a shepherd finds this ring, realizes it can make him invisible. He then conspires to kill the king and marry the queen, right? But what's interesting is when you dig down into this story, you find many more symbols. Again, deeply encoded, one of the things folk tales do is they super condense stuff, right? Because you have to have a story that you can tell like that. And when we read it or listen to it, we have to unpack those things. And one of the things I was telling my students the other day in class is that in a folk tale, and I probably got this from listening to Thompson, nothing is wasted. So, you know, poems and stories are very efficient. So they eliminate anything that's not symbolic, that doesn't carry meaning. So like in Little Red Riding Hood, the wolf carries meaning, the grandma carries meaning, the forest. So in the Ring of Gyges story, the setting and the different things that Gyges sees all carry meaning. And we can talk about that deeper if you want, but that's sort of my favorite example from the classical world of a story that contains hidden knowledge. And in particular, it contains technological knowledge, which is, you know, why I use it for my book.
I'm very afraid that I'm misattributing this quote completely and butchering the quote, but I feel like this is a quote that might've existed, that Einstein said something along the lines of, if you want intelligent children, read them fairy tales.
It may be, yeah. I mean, he's also, he has the quote about using imagination and not just sort of empirical, logical thinking. Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, fairy tales were the vehicle to teach children. You know, this idea of book learning and formalized schooling is a really, really recent historical artifact. It's sort of this, I tell my students, like a Prussian school system to sit in a row of chairs listening to an instructor. It's very, very recent invention. And so one of the jobs I think of a historian is to go and look at different ancient stories and unpack them. And you can go too far with this. There's a famous French linguist named Saussure. I don't know if you know Saussure. And he did this and he kind of looked for meaning in almost everything, which can be a little bit excessive. But certainly things like the other great example is the Atlantis story. And actually did a podcast. I was invited to do a podcast because that's also in the book. But the Atlantis story by modern people is either taken completely literally or completely as fiction. And if you really read it carefully, and there's some good modern commentaries on this as well, it's obviously encoded information because it has the symbolic structure of the circles, the concentric rings, the numbers, but we've forgotten what it is. And there are probably hundreds of things like that in the books right behind you, those Loeb editions. You know, there's stuff in Cicero and in later authors like Macrobius, there's no question. Please, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm still always sad about the burning of the Library of Alexandria because you just think of all the things that have been lost.
Oh, yeah. Well, and so what you have is decontextualized stories. You know, so people read The Ring of Gyges and they read it one way. And you know, when I was researching that, every single source, all they talked about was it's a morality tale. But ancient people weren't so stupid. You know, they would understand all the multiple other lessons being projected by these things, or, you know, a story like the Odyssey or anything like that.
Yeah, I often think about that. I'm a big fan of Sappho, and you know, people love to sort of project modern situations on her. And it's interesting though, because when the ancients had her entire codex at their availability, they had a very different interpretation of her poetry than we like to have. And so it's interesting because you said we're missing so much context and we're missing so many other references and you know, sequels and prequels and all that stuff that really fills out that information. But I also wanted to touch on the technology bit as well, the second part of your book. We had Adrian Mayer on the podcast as well to talk about ancient robots and the idea that, you know, people were envisioning technology before they created it, which I just think is such a eye-opener with regards to the world, that how imaginative they could be with technology.
When her book came out, it's funny, it came out roughly the same time mine did, and I emailed her, and she was very polite. She was sort of the model thinker. She was polite, and she emailed me right back, and she promoted my book on her site, and then I cited her book in a presentation I gave. And, you know, it turned out we had sort of stumbled across this same idea where there's technological speculation among ancient people. So robots, for example, the example I used was in the Arabian Nights. You find this very, to me, very interesting story called The City of Brass, and it mentions robots that are guards of this abandoned city. And then I told her in the email, I said, there's a whole nother technological aspect of that story as well. But yeah, wonderful book and wonderful person, you know, investigating the same kind of stuff. In my book, the chapters are divided up in these different speculations. So speculations on flight, speculations on remote communication, like video, speculations on this idea, as I said, that technology can develop to such a point that it implodes. So you find very, very sophisticated ideas. And then I kind of like look at where they could come from, which gets, I mean, that's like, would merit a whole separate program. It's a really difficult idea in terms of investigating the ancient mind.
So this is a question I've got. So I'm a big fan of the pre-Socratics. Which I don't like calling them pre-Socratics because I feel like that's relegating them to too much of a category. I was like, no, we should call them the first philosophers or something. I'm working on a campaign to give them a new branding. But a lot of the things that they came up with, you know, are so mind-boggling advanced. And you wonder that, like, how were they able to do that without telescopes, without microscopes? And then I sort of juxtapose that to the idea of, like, I often think of Caligula's Nemi ships, which, you know, had the ball bearings that were discovered. And, you know, I think, what was it, when Mussolini drained the lakes.
He drained the lake.
Yeah, and they found these amazing technology that was produced under Caligula. And then when they sort of did the Damnatio Arone and, you know, kind of wanted to get rid of all evidence of him because he was so hated, they sunk these ships, and some of the technology in there was so advanced that we didn't realize that they had that. They weren't reinvented until the Renaissance. So my question, by long preamble, is, are there cool technologies you think that maybe that they, is there any like literary evidence or some idea that maybe they actually did invent a lot of these things that were like, maybe they did have telescopes or something?
Well, this is very interesting you asked that. And you know, unfortunately, I got to give you a complicated answer. So when you're writing an academic book, right, and I was writing this for Brill, the publisher in the Netherlands, and they were great, by the way, and they assigned me two manuscript readers, One was American, one was Australian. Very nice guys, and both did like history of technology. They were kind of nerdy. And we had this discussion. They happened to be in Philadelphia. I took them out to dinner. And the problem is, if you're too speculative, then you're like Von Daniken or Graham Hancock, you know what I mean? I'm talking about that. So I couldn't sort of go there and say like, yeah, there were these advanced technologies and then they were lost. You know, they were brought to us by aliens or an advanced race. But then I also didn't want to go the other way, which is just this boring academic thing. And not just because it's boring, because I didn't believe it, which just say like, well, they had this idea, but then they didn't develop it, or maybe they stumbled across the idea of ball bearings or flight. So I spent a lot of time in kind of the opening chapters and the closing chapters of the book to give a really honest answer to exactly what you're asking. And so my thought is that it's very difficult to say, you know, because we don't have archaeological evidence for certain things. Like, we have archaeological evidence that the Romans had plumbing. We know that. Lead pipes. I've seen them in Bath, England, and I've seen them in Rome. But we don't have archaeological evidence for things like flying vehicles. You know, I was talking to my daughter about this. I said, I hope I live long enough that they're digging in Mongolia one day and they find these Chinese ancient aircraft. That would be great, because I can say I wrote the book about this. So in the book, I take a kind of skeptical tone. I view these stories as speculative. But to me, what was interesting was that almost all of these cultures, from, you know, the Hopi native peoples of the Americas to the Chinese, and you find these in other stories, they all have a very clear narrative of where they say these technologies are from. And the narrative, and this gets us back to the Ring Gaiji story, is always that there was an advanced civilization that had these technologies that collapsed, and now what we have are just these fragmentary stories. So my point is that in ancient times, people were having the same conversation you and I are having. So this is what's remarkable, that they were very knowledgeable of this idea that things tend to go to ground, right, and disappear and leave only fragments. So you'll read like in the Chinese text, for example, like there was this, emperor that commissioned this flying vehicle to be built to go from place to place. Now there are only stories that remain. You know, and they say this, they're quite explicit about this. Again, in my reading of the Ring of Gyges, I guess I'll try to describe this quickly. If you read the story in Plato and in other sources, there's an earthquake. Gyges the shepherd goes down into this opening in the earth, which you know is bad because going down in Plato is bad, it's the cave. Then he finds this huge bronze horse. That's bad, right? Because Troy, so anybody listening to this story would know it was bad. And then what's interesting is that inside this bronze horse is a naked body. That's bad because no culture inters their body naked. So there's all these negative connotations. And then the body is described as giant. And in every ancient source, there's this idea of a race of giants, metaphorically or literally, again, an advanced civilization. And then he finds this ring, which has technical powers. So that whole narrative right there is an example of this. Distant past, advanced civilization, destroyed itself. It obviously destroyed itself because technology without morality, there you go. And then in the same author in Plato, Atlantis tale. Same thing. So whatever we believe or watch on, you know, the sci-fi or history channel, that's one thing. But these people will answer your question by saying, oh yeah, there was an advanced civilization before us. No question about it. They invented all this stuff. We have bits and pieces. And you find that narrative over and over and over again. And I found that really, really interesting. So
yeah, it's super fascinating. I mean, I guess you're totally right, where you have to be cautious because, you know, people do kind of get carried away with those ideas as well. But just because it's fantastic doesn't mean it's not true either. You know what I mean? It's, you can't say one or the other. Like, you have to be, keep an open mind, but be critical.
Right, exactly. And as you say, I mean, there's certainly physical evidence of things that were quite sophisticated that are oddly decontextualized. Now, the example I use when I teach are a lot of stone structures. Like one of my favorite is in Baalbek, Lebanon, and I've never been able to see this in person, but there are these stones that weigh 2 million pounds, literally 2 million pounds. And, you know, I have a friend who does stone work, and he said, yeah, you can carve that with enough time, but it still kind of is this question of this highly sophisticated way of doing things that kind of appears and then it's gone like that. And there's this suggestion, and there was something. And, you know, one of my dreams is to work closely with an archaeologist, and together we can match textual accounts with some physical evidence. And then that would affirm, you know, what you're talking about speculatively.
Well, and you think, like, I mean, we've already seen the pattern. We've seen the pattern several times, because we obviously had the Dark Ages and such. And we look at, like, the paintings of Giotto or something, and we're like, oh, wow, look, they're just starting to get 3D again. And then you go back, you know, thousands of years, and you're like, wow, they knew how to paint so much better, you know, Apelles, or, you know, even the Fayum mummy portraits, or, you know, and then similarly, you think of the Dark Ages before the Golden Age of Athens, you had the Mycenaeans. So you're like, we see this pattern that's happened. So why would we assume that it didn't go further back, I suppose?
Right. Well, I told my daughter, you know, an example of very sophisticated knowledge, you might know this, is in Cicero or Seneca, where they describe the earth as this tiny point in space. It's making this kind of stoic point of, like, why do we struggle and care about fame? We're just a speck in the universe. And she said, well, how could they even conceptualize that? Because in the modern period, you know, Earth Day was in 1970, after the first images of Earth viewed from space were disseminated to the public. And yet the Romans were able to conceptualize this thousands of years before, you know? So there are many examples, and you wonder, did they see it in some other way? It's very, very hard to say. And I should add, you know, for the sake of your program, I think this fits perfectly, because you talk to a lot of academics. This is one of the issues with academic research, is these subjects that will just be untouched because they're either taken over by speculative television or they just die in academia. So what you have to do is use very hard academic tools to examine this, to show how interesting this stuff is without killing it. And just as an aside, I remember I was invited, that was probably 10 years ago or more, to a conference on very speculative maps and exploration. It was all amateurs. It was up, I think, in Nova Scotia. There's guys that, like, believed that all these people had come to the Americas before Columbus. And the guy who invited me is a very nice guy. I said, why are you inviting me? And he says, we need, like, an academic to make everything sober, but that can talk to these people. And I said, perfect. And we had a great time, and they respected me and I respected them. But in academia, this has been, you know, I'm able to do it because I teach at an arts institution, but I'm glad your program exists for this too.
No, it's interesting because, you know, Classical Wisdom is, we're partnered also with Ancient Origins, and it's a site that is more focused on this side of things. So I guess in a way, our two publishing companies are in a marriage of these sorts, in a way. But yeah, sometimes it veers, it's a careful line. It's definitely, right. Definitely a careful line. So I want to take another turn though, just because I know we don't have tons of time. But I'd like to touch on your second book, which I think kind of ties in a little bit with what we're saying about understanding reality. And your second book is Deciphering Reality, which you sort of, it's sort of been described as sort of a combination of physics, philosophy, and consciousness. And I think that's another really interesting part of ancient history and modern history, and showing that those two things sort of interconnect still. So how did the ancient Greeks sort of understand reality? Do you think they understood it very differently than we understand now?
Right. Yeah, you had asked me that question in email, and it was great. And I actually typed out an answer because I said, I really want to give a clear answer to this. So I think the way I describe it when I teach, not to sound too pedantic, is a good way of talking about this. So if we look at how the ancient world viewed reality, we also have to be conscious of how indigenous people view reality, because I'm very interested in, like, native peoples and their thinking. So the way I talk about it when I teach is diachronic and synchronic. So in the present, synchronically, all you have to do is go to other cultures. And I think you mentioned this in your email about Latin American cultures, and you see a totally different conception of time and space, et cetera. So synchronically, you can do this. So when you're in another culture, it's like being in humanity's past. And I was in places like Sri Lanka that were really clear examples of this. And then when you're asking about diachronically, absolutely. When we go to the ancient world in East or West, you see a very different view of reality itself. So the great example you asked about the Greeks is this idea of logos, right? So you find this in the Stoics most clearly. So when you explain to somebody what logos means, well, it means word, right? It also means reason, but it also means natural law. So how do those go together? And it's astonishing how difficult it is for students to understand this because we separate all those things out. But I said, look around you. Everything is a natural pattern. The pandemic spreads in a natural pattern. The fact that it arose is part of the natural pattern. The seasons change, natural pattern. The earth moves, natural pattern. So for ancient Greeks, they understood that reality followed a natural law. B, they also understood that we, as part of that natural law, have to function in accordance with that. And we have what I call valence, to use the kind of Latin word. We can negotiate with it, you know. We're not powerless, so it's not nihilistic, but we're made of the same stuff, so we have to adhere with that. So that concept of the ancient world is very different from ours. How? Because in the present, and I dog students about this all the time, because young people in particular were infused with this idea nowadays with agency. You know, and if you hear kids like in high school, they're taught, you can do whatever you want. You can be whatever you want. You can choose anything. You can choose your gender, your identity, your. And I said, well, no, you can't, because there are restrictions in terms of certain laws. You may be able to change certain things, including your gender, including your name, including your identity. But you also have to understand that there's this overarching natural law. And a much better thing, I think, to teach kids is we're like surfers, right? Where you can go someplace, but you're always in negotiation. So that's the big difference between the ancient world and our world in terms of view of reality. We view reality as out there, and we're independent actors. They viewed reality as permeating everything. And the one way students get this is when they cite Star Wars, like the force is described as through the universe and through us. And then, bam, they get it. So I think to answer your question, that's the biggest difference between the ancient view of reality and the contemporary view of reality.
Well, I am to your point about traveling, I've always said, I love that Bertrand Russell quote, because he talks about that. If you want to travel in time, just travel to different places. And at the time he used New York as the future and China as the past. But I would now say, if you go to Shanghai and that's the future, it's totally swapped. But you know, that's interesting. And I think maybe another part of the difference in understanding is like in our Western culture now, we're so individualistic, but in the ancient cultures, it was a much more community-based culture. And I think you get a sense of that when you're in the Far East, that kind of community mindset and how much that affects people's actions if they think community-based versus individually-based. And I don't know if that sense changes your perception of reality as well.
Absolutely. And I talk about that in my book. So there are two aspects to what you're saying. So the first is, if you study Taoism, you'll see it's almost identical to Stoicism in the sense that the word Tao, which means in Chinese a path or a road, it's Do in Japanese. That's the idea, same thing. There's this natural law and we have to behave in accordance with that. But what you also find in Eastern culture, and this is probably the most dominant practice philosophy in the East, is Confucianism. So in Confucianism, it's network analysis, that basically you're always in a community, right? Individuals who are connected, you know, in Confucianism, it's the five relationships, right? So parent-child, teacher-student, sibling relationships. So no person is an individual. You're always a node in a network. And anything you do is either beneficial or harmful, right, in this node network relationship. And there's a wonderful professor of Chinese philosophy who's written about this, and he calls it role ethics. And you can find examples in the Greek world too, where you're taught that you are individual, but connected to family, to tribe, et cetera. And that definitely influences your views of reality two ways. One is that you're not an independent actor, but also in a subtle way, and only the existentialists in the West kind of get this idea that you and me and then my wife and my child, my teacher, my students, together we create reality, that reality is just a summation of all these points, that there's no external reality at all. That community is reality we create, and we can create a nightmare or we can create something really good through those, that node and network system. And that's a very, again, very difficult concept to communicate to people. It's very different. I mean, I see it because I've lived there, and yeah, as you say, it's practiced every day. It's not practiced perfectly, but yeah, it characterizes Eastern cultures to a great extent.
And so I know we're running out of time, so I will then, as a last question, ask about the concept of time, because I think that's another part of that reality. And as I wrote to you, you know, it's funny, anybody who's spent a lot of time in South America will know that time has a very different meaning to maybe what we've lived and experienced, say, in the US or in Europe. And just as like a little funny anecdote, sorry, is that I remember, you know, when we first moved down here to Buenos Aires, we threw a parrilla, you know, an asado, and everybody comes to a barbecue. And I think we said it was going to start around 8. And, you know, people first started showing up around 10. And I think around midnight, some of our friends showed up, and we were like, oh, we didn't think you were coming. And they were like, why did you think that? They couldn't even understand why we would think it was odd that at midnight, we were shocked to see them.
Yeah. Like in Brazil, it's sempre amanhã. Like it's always, vai ser amanhã. It's always tomorrow, right? Mañana. Yeah, it's a very different conception of time. Like 8 o'clock means 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock means 12 o'clock, right? Absolutely. And I think that's sort of the contemporary differences in conceptions of time. It's a great question, and it's a very complex question. So one of the things I should tell everybody that's listening to this is there's a great book, if you're interested in it, Time and Temporality in the Ancient World by a guy named Ralph Rosen. It's on your website if you want to do a bibliography. It's a great book. And he edited these essays, and they talk about this different conception of time in the ancient era, which is what you're asking about. What's interesting, and this goes back to something else I said, is probably the main difference in the ancient view of time, the contemporary view of time, in the meta sense, and you probably already know this, is cyclical versus linear, right? So as I said, you know, almost every ancient culture, East or West, viewed time this way. So humans progress and then decline, progress and decline, or complete, eternal recurrence, that literally everything happens all over again. No, it's Groundhog Day kind of thing. And what really sets modern people apart, and I think causes modern culture enormous amount of psychic stress, we view time as linear, and also we have this this obsession with eschatology, this idea that there has to be progress. It's this teleological view that you start here and you got to end up here. And no ancient cultures had this. It just was beyond their conception. So in the meta view of time was very different. And then the everyday view of time is different. As you pointed out, you can go to all kinds of cultures in Italy or in Latin America and see this. And you also see this in a sort of more subtle way, that cultures that are not bound to the clock, because they just don't have that much to do. So it's interesting, like you can be in Buenos Aires and experience that. Buenos Aires is very sophisticated, and they're very westernized. But what I found fascinating when I was in places like Sri Lanka, and this is a long time ago, and this is in the 80s, that the people I was with complained, like we had to go somewhere and do this. I said, there's nothing to do. You know, so why would you think about time? And when you have a kid, like you ask your kid, what time is it? They don't know and don't care because there's nothing to do. So I think the ancient view of the world is stuff arose, like meal times, right? And there were tasks to be done. But there wasn't this view that there was always something to do. I remember, this is the story I wanted to tell to give you a quick answer to your question. So I was 19 years old. We did a winter term in college. We went to Sri Lanka, there were about 17 of us, and we were working on farms throughout the country and studying there. And you would just, we would sleep in the open air, and you would just feel somebody prodding you like this, and you got up and you did some farming, and you did different tasks, prepared food. And then at some point you ate, and then at some point you sat, and then at some point somebody brought lunch, and then at some point you took a nap, and we never had any idea what time it was. And everything kind of worked though. That's what struck me, is like, wow, stuff got done, you know, and that was just remarkable to me. And then the other funny aspect of the story, there was a young Sri Lankan guy that was helping lead our group, and I noticed he had a watch. I was like, wow. So maybe I'm wrong, people do tell time. And I looked at the watch and it was broken. And I said, what's with that? He goes, oh, it's just jewelry. It's just decoration. And I thought, you know, again, there's a window into how humans probably lived for 100,000 years. And they did it, you know, they did it without formal time. Yes, the view of time was very, very different in the ancient world. And then as I say, there are many other aspects of this which I get into in the book, which we can talk about, because that's the research I'm doing right now. So,
great question. That'd be really interesting. And yeah, I mean, I was thinking just like, I guess when you think of time, you were saying before about seasons maybe being more cyclical and things like that. Right. And it's interesting because you think of, again, to bring it sort of full circle, a lot of the mythologies that involve cycles, like the mythology of Demeter and Persephone and all these ones that kind of encode this idea of seasons and life, right, and redress and all that kind of stuff.
Everything in the ancient world. So if you take the Greek myths, if you take Stoic philosophy, it's cyclical. Plato clearly lays this out. And Plato has a teleological idea in terms of enlightenment, you know, the cave allegory in that sense. But in general, in the ancient world, all the way up into Christianity, you find cyclical ideas. It's Christianity which really shifts everything to a very clearly teleological, and again, this sort of eschatological idea of end times, et cetera, and enforces that. And that's an interesting split in the ancient world, which is also something to talk about. So,
well, I think this is definitely a conversation to be continued in a cyclical or progressing manner.
Hope so.
So just to finish up, can you just tell us very quickly what you're working on right now? And I will also put links to all of your books down below so that everyone can catch those.
Thank you. So I'm working on a book about the nature of time from the perspective of philosophy and physics. And one of the interesting things is I kind of have to dive into culture to do that, because cultural frameworks shape how we do scientific investigations nowadays. And the other thing that I've also been working on is a study of ancient ideas of divination, right? So divination is practiced by the Greeks, the Romans, Chinese, and I spent a little bit of time in West Africa. And one of the things that I stumbled across was that West Africans in Nigeria and Ghana, there's a system of divination, which is just like the I Ching, the Chinese system of divination. And why is that interesting? Well, because actually none of these are systems of divinations. They're systems of viewing how the world works, networks, patterns, history. So a lot of really, really interesting stuff. So I'm working on a shorter paper about that. And then I'm working on this study of time. So plenty of stuff to do, which is
plenty
great.
Of stuff.
Yeah. And I want to thank you not only for having me on the program, but I also want to thank you for really good questions, which is not always the case in life. I really appreciate that. They made me think about this stuff a lot, which was great.